find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Say.
You break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 265. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. And we've been yodeling so much. I can't yodel. I'm getting lightheaded, Andrew. I've been all the yodeling. How are you doing?
I agree. It's been it seems like we just started recording minutes ago, actually. No. We did the special episode on Tuesday. We're back again on Thursday. We're hitting you and I were talking about this offline. It's not quite YodelCon 1. But it's definitely YodelCon 2, right?
We need to reserve YodelCon 1 for real yodel emergencies, you know,
like, yeah.
Some sort of yodel massacre or the actual Mueller report coming out. One of the, like, a yodel nuclear war. There's like, we can't go to one, you know, like, there's got to be, you got to keep it, you know, that's special. Yeah. But two, I think we're at YodelCon 2.
Yeah, it's the end of War Games. The Whopper is, you know, trying to decode the secret 10-digit code that will enable us to get the Mueller report. But, you know, we'll talk about all that on the show.
But you know what's unfortunate, though, is we're not allowed to release our full episodes. We just have to have Barr do a summary, like a 3-minute summary of our episodes. So we don't even know what the people are going to be hearing.
Yeah, if the ratio is correct, then the Attorney General will release a 6-second summary of every opening argument.
Yeah, it'll just be, and then it's done. Like, it's just a bit brief yodel. That's all you could fit. Wow. Okay. Well, we've got a great episode for you. We've got an interview with Professor Randall Eliason, who's been on the show before. Very, very well thought out, reasoned voice on these issues. You know, another way to make sure. We never want to get too carried away with anything. You know, that's we do our best here. I think Andrew does a great job of keeping us tethered to reality. And thus, when Andrew sounds the alarm about something, you can genuinely be alarmed, as opposed to a lot of other sources, which is they're just in YodelCon 1 all the time, every day. And no longer special. it doesn't work anymore. So I'm excited for that interview. We have a little bit of housekeeping here before that, because I think we've got some Andrew's was his rights and Andrew was his wrongs.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Yeah, I think that's right. So let's start off with the Andrew was wrong. On Tuesday's episode, here's what I said in response to the first sentence that we were breaking down from the Barr indictment. That sentence of the Barr indictment, the Barr summary of the Mueller report. That the Barr indictment is coming later.
Yeah.
So the first sentence that I started to deconstruct is Barr saying, "The report does not recommend any further indictments, nor did the special counsel obtain any sealed indictments that have yet to be made public." And I explained that the purpose of that sentence was to convey that the Mueller report does not contain an indication that there is a sealed indictment of the president as an unindicted, you know, does not contain a sealed indictment of the president, right?
Or like Don Jr. or like anybody, right?
Right, or anybody, right, yeah. But the reason Don Jr., there's no reason not to just have a pending indictment of Don Jr., the reason to have a sealed indictment of the president is the question regarding whether you can indict a sitting president, right? I pointed out as I was starting to jump the gun that that doesn't rule out the president being named as an unindicted co-conspirator, although you know, again, speculation, but that seems unlikely. But what I said in addition to all of that was this also seems to contradict some facts that we know, in particular, that there is a pending indictment of Julian Assange. And folks have written in, and again, this is, I just whiffed on this. In fact, we talked to Professor Eliason about this a little bit. The Assange indictment is from the Eastern District of Virginia, and we do not know. I want to be super clear about this. We do not know if that Eastern District of Virginia indictment is a handoff from Mueller. That would be my guess, because and that guess is based on what we have seen from the Roger Stone indictment and from the Corsi plea deal that was ripped up. Right. We saw both Assange, who was referred to as individual-1, and WikiLeaks, which was referred to as organization-1, in those indictments and in that plea deal. So it is obvious that Assange and WikiLeaks was on Mueller's radar. But it certainly is also possible that the Eastern District of Virginia's indictment of Assange is was not a handoff, was a parallel and separate investigation. We do not know. So what that does is, I think I said that sentence was false.
You
that
did.
Makes the sentence.
I'll call you out. You said it was false. You said it was unequivocally false.
Yep. And that's a clear error on my part. What that does is that makes the statement technically correct, but highly misleading, like the rest of the Barr summary.
So what you're saying is total exoneration.
Total exoneration of the president. Nothing more to see here. It is very, very important that we police ourselves and we be correct. And I had that mischaracterized in my notes. And so want to take responsibility for that. I was definitely wrong on that.
Yeah, I think it fits in with the Barr theme of being technically correct, which is the best kind of correct.
The best kind of correct.
Being very careful to make sure he's technically defensibly correct, seems like.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that, you know, it leads into, I want to salve the pain of the burn of being wrong with, I kind of feel like we were right in the main on our episode. You know, what we described was the economics of the media cycle, and that, you know, while Republicans won the first 24 hours as media sources were rushing to be first, we predicted that they were going to lose the next couple of days. And I think you've seen that, right? We've been, you know, tweeting. I don't even need to highlight the dozen or so articles that we have tweeted out and shared from our social media accounts. It's very, very obvious now that they've done instant polling, right?
I was going to comment on that. I think the poll said like 60, maybe somewhere in the 60, like 64% of people think that the report doesn't exonerate Trump. And I was like, okay, that's cool, except the words "this report doesn't exonerate the president" are in the report. So like, you'd hope it would be 100, like in an ideal world, should be 100% of people can read, you know, like can it like look be. At it and be like, oh, it says this also does not exonerate him. 64 though, I guess I'll take it, or whatever it was, 62, something like that. I'll take it. It's better. It's, you know, it's a majority position at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, that's exactly what we said would happen, and exactly where I would expect that we are. I want to tie up a couple of questions that folks have asked us in connection with that Tuesday episode, right? So the first is, a number of people have asked, how is it possible that we're going to get the full Mueller report, right? Amid reports that Attorney General Barr is going to redact the report. There was an initial report. I think the Attorney General's office walked it back, but there was an initial report that they were going to give it to the White House first and consult with them. Yeah. And so people kind of are rightfully thinking maybe the Attorney General will just bury this forever. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to speak to that a little bit. And
well, I also want to say, I mean, I think this is a product of new listeners, you know, because you've covered this a lot. But we get those comments that are like, I can't believe you didn't talk about how you know, it's like, all right, well, bear in mind, you know, you might have missed an episode before you come at us like
or
this.
Or 263 of them. Yeah.
Exactly. Because, yeah, you've talked about this before, but worth a review.
Yeah. So let's say a couple of things here, right? The first, this was actually a question my son asked me. I haven't seen from anybody else, but I thought it was perhaps something that folks didn't know. The reason the Mueller report is called the Mueller report is because that's what it is, right? It is a narrative summary of the investigation. That narrative summary, we have seen differing reports, is at least 300 pages. I would be shocked if it were not double or triple that, for the reasons we talked about on episode 264.
Just like font size and spacing. No, I'm just kidding. Just all the exhibits and everything.
and that is just the narrative portion, right? The underlying evidence will run to the tens of thousands of pages. Those are the 302s, the interviews, the president's written answers. All of that stuff is going to be extensive, are going to be volumes and volumes of information. But it's also important to remember, when I say that it is a report, Mueller's report in and of itself has no legal significance or implication, right? Mm. It does not, it's not a charging document. It has no, in other words, if you're thinking about it as, well, how is this going to come out and, you know, who has control over it and can the Attorney General, what's valuable about the Mueller report is the information that it contains. So keep that in mind. And that was just something, again, I think my son is a reasonably bright 16-year-old, and he was like, well, you know, is the actual report going to come out, and can, you know, the president be indicted or impeached if we only get, you know, some of it coming out piecemeal or through other channels? And so I thought it was worth pointing out. What's valuable is the information that it contains. The way in which that information comes out is not at all important, right?
So it's, I see. So he's coming from it's like, it's not as though that's like evidence where if you bury that evidence, then it's just like, no, the information can be used to charge somebody. You know what I mean? So it's not like if they can hide that, then everything's fine as long as no one actually gets their hands on the actual report.
Right. Yeah. Like okay, one I of see. The, what was the Lord Awful movies that we did with, was it Changing Lanes, right? Where you have to have the original document or else, you know, I forget what the stupid movie. Tortured thing was.
That was a really bad movie.
New Lord Awful movies coming up this month, by the way. Mm. It's not like that, right? The document itself doesn't have to be served, contains no separate legal value. It's just the information that's in it. And the House of Representatives already jointly, Jerry Nadler, Elijah Cummings, and others, House Oversight, House Judiciary, those committees have requested that the Attorney General turn over the full Mueller report by Tuesday, April 2nd. I doubt that Bill Barr will comply at that time. We will be on the lookout for it. He will probably release some kind of letter that says, well, we're still redacting highly sensitive grand jury testimony and all that nonsense. And we talked to Professor Eliason about that in the next segment. As Congress gets stonewalled, their next set of options is to subpoena Bill Barr, to subpoena Robert Mueller, to subpoena Rod Rosenstein. There are enough individuals who are going to comply with that subpoena or who, you know, are potential whistleblowers that I am as confident as I can be, right? We live in strange times. I was also pretty confident that we were going to get a vote on the Supreme Court in 2016. So, you know, it black swan events can happen. I'm as confident as I can be in the era of Trump that report will get in unredacted form to the Democratic leaders in the House of Representatives. That's going to happen. And that's why you're not seeing, you didn't see the panic on the first day that you saw in a great many quarters from, you know, folks like Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and Elijah Cummings. They know that this is coming, and it is.
All right. Well, I think we need to deal with the elephant in the room, which is something a lot of people posted, which was like, oh, the end. It's the end of Yodel Mountain. The end of Yodel Mountain. I'm looking at this like, what are you talking about? I don't even know why you would think of that. First off, there's so much more yodeling to do. Yodel Mountain goes as long, at least, at a minimum, conservative estimates have Yodel Mountain living at least as long as this president. But also, I mean, Yodel Mountain's forever. You know, it's a state of mind, for one. But also, it's like, I feel like it's already entered the national lexicon, you know? And it's like... It's like everything is something gate, you know, Russia gate. It was Russia gate, you know, that was from friggin' Watergate in the 70s. Yodel Mountain is at least as good as that. So yeah. I feel like it can last that long.
The real Yodel Mountain is in your heart.
That's true. But also, I mean, think of how many more things we have to yodel about, you know, like even if Trump yodels himself off a cliff one day, you know, God willing, he just yodels, falls right off that cliff. We still have all the trash he left on Yodel Mountain that we got to clean up, you know, with tears in our eyes. It's all kinds of stuff, meaning we got to dismantle the damage he's done. We've got to trace through the threads of other corruption charges. I mean, there's so much. There's so much to do. And there'll never be an end to Yodel Mountain. It'll always at least live on in our hearts. But getting ahead of yourselves, I think, you know, it's still very much alive right now.
So our friends over at Mueller, she wrote, have used the epithet, the investigation is over, but the prosecutions continue. I like that. I've modified it a little bit to the investigation is over, right? The Russia probe itself is over, has ended. Mueller has gone home. But the investigations continue. and that's true, right? There are 19 separate investigations that are presently open. There are trials that are currently pending. There's a ton that is still out there that is all Yodel Mountain. And we're not leaving our base camp anytime soon. So, in fact, we've had to bump this twice now. I really, really want to talk about two crucial investigations in the Southern District of New York that are incredibly interesting that bear into the president. In connection with the presidential inaugural. We've teased that a little bit, but oh my gosh, that is a treasure trove of corruption, of potential, I should say, potential corruption. And the second is the Southern District just released the redacted versions of the 9 separate search warrants that were issued in connection with the raid on Michael Cohen and his home and his hotel room and his offices. And that teaches us an awful lot.
It's well worth noting that if we lived in a different time, say 3 years ago, that if the president, the Mueller probe, forget that even existed. If the president just had these investigations going, it would be absolute catastrophe for any other administration. I mean, 19 major real investigations into very real possibilities of corruption, and some of which already, like, you know, pretty much proven. Another sign that this frustrating narrative, you know, war was won by a bunch of belligerent Republicans and angry Glenn Greenwalds the other day. There's so much more going on. This total exoneration is a joke.
I will say it this way. If the only thing that were pending against incumbent President Hillary Clinton, right, were the equivalent of Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Then I would support articles of impeachment against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And they would have been drawn up. I mean, they would have been drawn up on, you know, January 28th, 27th, you know.
I'm pretty sure they're still trying to impeach Hillary.
Yeah, yeah. Lindsey Graham is retroactively trying to make sure that she was never born. It's the plot of Time Cop, only it's, you know, with Hillary Clinton and Lindsey Graham played by Jean-Claude Van Damme. Yeah, and look, but it's why I wanted to lead with that, right? It is not just that, of course, Republicans would be trying to delegitimize a Democratic presidency. That goes without saying. I would be on board, right? If we learned
plus
that
Tim
Hillary
Kaine,
Clinton,
pretty cool guy,
yeah,
President Kaine,
yeah. If we had learned that Hillary Clinton had suppressed critical stories a week and a half prior to the election, an election that presumably she would have won by, you know, 70,000
swing votes. And by the way, writing,
hundreds
of thousands of dollars in campaign funds, you know, all that.
Yep.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
All of that. Yeah.
We would say, that means this is a corrupt person who shouldn't be president.
Absolutely. 100%. And let's call it, look, if Liz Warren does that in 2020, then, you know, get her out. Like that's the thing. Ongoing theme of this show, right? That those of us on the left, we're happy to kick out when it's our guys and our gals who are doing it. So anyway, that was a great point, Thomas. Yodel Mountain is here to stay. Yodel Mountain is clear as Kushner. Yodel Mountain is Stormy Daniels. There is, even if Barr's summary were correct, which it, you know, go back and listen to Tuesday's episode. Even if it were correct, there would still be Yodel Mountain, and for good reason. So there we go.
Hey, listeners, Opening Arguments is brought to you by Quip. You know, one of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth, and yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers, and it was designed to make brushing your teeth simpler, more affordable, and even enjoyable. If you are still using, 18th century toothbrush technology, you need to get in on Quip, because they've got sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle enough on your sensitive gums. And sometimes people brush too hard, or the electric toothbrushes are too abrasive, but not Quip. And here's the thing, this is life-changing, guys. The built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides, which I think, left to my own devices, who in the world knows how much time? I probably put all the time on the first quadrant and then rush through the others, and who knows? But this makes sure you have a consistent 2-minute brush every single time. And brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. Those are just some of the reasons why I love Quip, and why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/OA right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. I highly recommend you take advantage of this. Get your first refill pack free at getquip.com/OA. That's getquip.com/OA. All right. Well, we could talk about this forever, but we've got to get to our interview with Professor Eliason. So let's hop on over to that. And we are joined by Professor Randall Eliason. Thank you so much for coming on. We needed you.
Hey guys, my pleasure. Nice to be back.
Yeah, you saw the bat signal and you came. I'm very, very excited to have you.
Thank you,
Andrew. I think I would. I don't know that I'm going to do like all the Republicans did on the in the Blasey Ford testimony and just yield my time to Andrew to ask you some very detailed questions. Go ahead.
I'm in trouble now.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. All right. Well, what? For those who may be new to Opening Arguments, Randall Eliason, former prosecutor and current law professor at George Washington University, graduated from the only law school that matters. You and I overlapped a bit in our private professional life? I mean, is there anything else on your credentials I need to get out? Anything you want to plug before we get into the questions?
Nope, let's go to it.
All right. So, okay. What we're trying to do is parse through Attorney General Bill Barr's summary of the Mueller report. We're doing that without having access to the Mueller report, so it's a little bit of a challenge. And there are a few questions that are sort of hanging out there that, in my view, are, an area that I thought would be perfect to have a former prosecutor weigh in. So let's start. I sent you a list in advance. We talked offline about one and two. Why don't we start with three? According to the Barr report, to the Barr summary, the part one of the Mueller report dealing with the direct conspiracy allegations is limited to what we've been calling the Cambridge Analytica type of evidence, right? That is the social media disinformation campaign being carried out by Russian troll farms and related agents. And then the what we would call the WikiLeaks component, right? Hacking into the DNC emails. And so Barr's summary specifically says that on those two grounds of conspiracy that the Mueller report reaches no conclusion or reaches a conclusion that neither Donald Trump nor any Americans involved with his campaign specifically colluded with Russia on those two grounds. So first question, why would the Mueller report only limit itself to those two areas of inquiry? Or, yeah, go ahead. Why don't you run with that for a little bit?
Yeah, so these are, you know, the two areas where he's returned the big indictments of you know, two dozen Russians last year, one for the social media disinformation campaign and one for the email hacking and WikiLeaks allegations. So, and if you want to talk about a Mueller report, I mean, those two indictments sort of serve as a Mueller report, at least when it comes to the Russian meddling with the election. So the big unknown was always, you know, did anyone from the Trump campaign sort of actively work with them or, you know, collude with them? And if you want to use the collusion word, conspiracy, and that's what the report is saying Mueller did not find, or at least did not find sufficient evidence to bring a criminal case. So it would have been the same type of allegation, you know, and it could have been a similar kind of conspiracy charge, but it just would have been, members of the Trump campaign sort of actively working with the Russians to try to help them interfere with the election. And that appears to be what Mueller didn't find, at least sufficient to bring a criminal case. So that is the quote-unquote collusion allegation. And Barr's summary is saying Mueller didn't find enough there to make that a criminal case against the members of the Trump campaign, even though it already is a criminal case against the Russians themselves.
That makes sense. Can we conclude from the way in which Barr's summary is written that the Mueller report is silent about the broader elements of collusion? And again, you know, you and I have had this conversation previously, but I mean, I think kind of the average politically informed person on the left, our concerns about broader conspiracy, not necessarily been limited to just the Cambridge Analytica or the WikiLeaks stuff, but kind of more broadly, Donald Trump as a candidate changed the Republican Party platform to make it more favorable to Russia, and as a president has changed U.S. foreign policy in ways to make it more favorable to Russia, and that seems to be, you know, sort of the much broader concern, you know, at least the ones that, you know, you and I have talked about. Can we conclude from this wording that Mueller's report is silent on those, or how do you interpret that?
I don't know. I mean, that's another reason, obviously, we've got to see the report, right?
Right.
It's hard to say. I'm sure you would imagine there's a lot of information in the report relevant to overall, again, quote unquote, collusion or contacts. I mean, because to explain his conclusions, Mueller would have to, you would think, talk about all these different allegations that are sort of out there and known publicly, and talk about why he, you know, concluded those did not rise to the level of a conspiracy. So I think of it as collusion is this much broader universe of possible misconduct and all these, you know, contacts between the Trump campaign, you know, dozens and dozens of contacts between members of the Trump campaign and the Russians, and the things that, you know, Trump and his administration or his campaign did to favor the Russians. You know, there's all these suspicious contacts and things out there that all kind of fall under this larger umbrella of possible collusion, you know. And then the criminal conspiracy question is much narrower. And that was actually, and that was what Mueller was primarily charged with, you know, investigating. He's a criminal prosecutor. He's a federal prosecutor. So he's not really charged with saying, you know, coming up with a litany of all the bad things Trump did that are not criminal. He's charged with deciding whether they rose to the level of a criminal conspiracy. Now, he might, and there's a whole huge amount of stuff that might be, you know, reckless, naive, stupid,
impeachable,
unpatriotic, you know, but not criminal. And so I would expect a lot of the things like that are mentioned in the report, but whatever he found, he apparently concluded did not rise to the level of a provable criminal case, which is a far narrower standard and a far higher bar to prove, as you know.
Yeah. And what I guess the specific question, I had speculated earlier that in areas that would rise to the level of criminal conspiracy, but would fall outside of these two narrow lanes, that it is entirely possible that the report describes having handed those matters off to another jurisdiction. And I think the example from that that we know we can put together from the documents is the Southern District of New York handling the Michael Cohen cases. And I'm curious what you think of that speculation. If you think that's reckless or prudent, or what are your thoughts?
Well, there are definitely, you know, cases that we already know about that have been handed off or those sort of spun off from the Mueller investigation, like the SDNY case that you mentioned with the campaign finance violations. And also there is an investigation of the inaugural committee mm-hmm. and whether there was financial misconduct there. So, you know, there are, I don't know how many other additional investigations still pending. And I think Mueller, you know, probably, you know, properly interpreted his mandate fairly narrowly. And if something, you know, was suspicious about Trump's business dealings with Russia or, you know, other business dealings that maybe took place before he became president, but they didn't fall within Mueller's direct mandate of investigating, you know, again, he's not charged with investigating any possible conspiracy. He was charged with investigating conspiracy related to Russian interference with the 2016 election. And if it didn't fall within that mandate, I think he tended to hand it off. But, you know, the exact details of what may have gotten handed off in that regard, you know, I don't think we know yet. And I'm not sure we'd find that out.
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask. Like, would we know when he hands something off, does that become public, or do we have any indication of like how, what percentage of stuff he has handed off that we would know about or not?
Yeah, I don't think we would necessarily know about it unless some charges are filed. You know, we sort of, but there wouldn't be typically any kind of a public announcement about it or anything, because it's going to be a grand jury investigation. We might learn about it, you know, when people start receiving subpoenas and the defense attorneys or, you know, clients who receive them report that to the press and, you know, the word gets out, but you wouldn't necessarily know about it, certainly not right away. And I'm not sure it would be listed in the report necessarily either, or if it were, that part might be redacted to protect the confidentiality of those investigations.
I see. Could we still hold out hope that Don Jr. is involved in something like
that? Well, there's all kinds of, I think that there's all kinds of potential things still kind of lingering out there. You know, I've been very curious about the, I think there were several dozen witness transcripts that the House Oversight Committee, once the Democrats took over, they sent it over to Mueller to investigate for possible perjury allegations. You know, what happened to those? I mean, and that included, I think, Don Jr. You know, have those now been handed off to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, or did Mueller actually resolve those already? Or, you know, so there's a lot of kind of loose ends or unanswered questions. And I think we're going to be learning a lot more about what happened to all those allegations probably for quite some time.
I agree with you, but it sort of raises the question, and you know, I'll ask it about a number of people. None of this will be a surprise to you. If you're Robert Mueller, right, and you and I share, you know, an underlying agreement, you know, the same sort of set of assumptions that he is a careful, thorough, expert prosecutor who, you know, has acted in a nonpartisan way throughout the entirety of this investigation, right? Like that's, I think the evidence overwhelmingly demonstrates that. How could you reach a conclusion on each of these specific, you know, the each of these two specific areas of the, you know, the top line conspiracy charge, while we know that there's evidence that's still out there, right? So for example, you know, Roger Stone's trial hasn't happened yet. And Roger Stone, you know, through Randy Credico, is alleged to be the point of contact from the Trump campaign to WikiLeaks. So, you know, how could Mueller reach a definitive conclusion about that while there's still information, you know, beyond his control?
Sure. You know, on the Stone thing in particular, I think likely that he's learned enough about Stone and his activities to conclude that the Trump campaign may have been trying to gather information about what WikiLeaks was doing, as was the Clinton campaign, by the way. Everybody was trying to figure out what WikiLeaks was going to do and what they were planning. That's not criminal, right? Unless you're sort of working with them and planning the timing and helping them do it or something like that. And even looking at the Stone indictment, it reads like something where the campaign, you know, they're not actively working with WikiLeaks, but they're kind of sending a, you know, someone like Roger Stone off to do their errands to try to learn more on their behalf. It doesn't sound like somebody involved in some kind of high-level conspiracy with the Russians. If that's true, why are you using Stone to get information for you? So, you know, but that's the specific Stone thing. I think the broader question that you raise is a common one, and a classic problem in these big investigations is sort of, when do you pull the trigger? You know, there's always something more you could do. Always one more little lead you could run down, you know, one more piece of information you could try to find. At some point, you have to decide you've done enough, you've got enough to make a judgment and make a call. And if you look at Barr's letter, you know, the scope of this investigation is just astonishing. 2,800 subpoenas, 500 search warrants, 230 orders for telephone records or email records, 13 requests to foreign governments, 500 witness interviews. I mean, this was a massive, massive investigation. And at some point, you just make a professional judgment that I've seen enough, I've learned enough to make a call. And then you make it.
Okay. I follow that. So let's then kind of move aside from the area in which Mueller made a call, right, which was the part one related to collusion, conspiracy. And let's move to part two, where Mueller didn't make a call, right? This is the obstruction of justice investigation. And when you read between the lines of the Barr summary, you see that what he describes is that the Mueller report evidently lays out kind of the pro case for indicting the president for obstruction of justice and the evidence in connection therewith, and the con case, and then on the basis that includes views regarding the unique nature of indicting a sitting president, right? One in which, in fact, let's put a pin in that, because I'd like to know your view on whether a sitting president could be indicted. I've moved from a hard no to kind of a soft no, but we'll go ahead. We'll go down that one now. Yeah.
He says in the letter they did not base it on that. Footnote two.
Barr says that we just went through this and parsed this really, really carefully. Barr says that he and Rosenstein did not reach the conclusion on the basis of whether the president can be indicted. But in the previous paragraph, it says that the special counsel therefore did not draw a conclusion, and the therefore refers to the previous sentence of the special counsel considered whether to evaluate the conduct under department standards governing prosecution and declination decisions, but ultimately determined, quote, not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment. Now, I read that. So maybe I should have made my assumption clear in the predicate of the question. This is what happens when I'm interviewing a smart lawyer. So I will do that now. I read, in my view, the only plausible reading of "we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment" is that the report says, hey, look, this is not your typical case. This is not just, you know, Thomas Smith being indicted for crime. This is a sitting president. And therefore, what we're going to do is setting out evidence on both sides of the issue. But, you know, we haven't made a decision. We haven't made a traditional prosecutorial judgment because it's the president, because we can't. Do you share that reading, or am I being overly optimistic? What do you think?
You know, that's a real mystery to me. That's the thing about this report that I find most puzzling, is the idea that Mueller didn't make that call. Because to me, an equally plausible way to approach that is to say, I'll make the judgment. I'll say, if he were not the president, we would indict him for obstruction, right? But because we can't indict the president, or because of these special circumstances, we're not making that call. But, you know, to not make the call at all seems a little, I can't quite figure out why he took that route. But I think the best guess is that he probably felt that, again, because it's the president, that his best course of action, I mean, given, you know, like you said, he can't just go out and indict the president on his own. He'd certainly have to, you know, that would require some kind of massive shift in DOJ policy, that his best approach is just to lay out the pros and the cons. And whether it's the attorney general or Congress, you know, he's going to leave it to some other body to assess those facts and decide what kind of actions are appropriate. You know, but whether that's because of the policy that the president can't be indicted, or whether it's because of the concerns about, you know, alleging obstruction based on official executive actions like firing the FBI director, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page there. And I guess I would summarize that. I mean, you know, we've both come out that. I think the net effect of this Barr summary is to look, is to win the media day, you know, in the first 12 hours for Donald Trump. But I think the net effect is that it's going to move very, very quickly towards a consensus to release the full report. And I would just point out that, in my view, there's nothing. I mean, you know, Bill Barr has been a lawyer for 42 years. I think he's got both you and I maybe combined beat on that score of career of practicing law. And this is a very carefully worded letter. And I don't think there's anything in this letter that would be inconsistent, right? That would mischaracterize would meet the standard, certainly that would we meet the standard for perjury, or, you know, anything like that would prevent the report, when we see it, from saying, from even going so far as to say, if this were an ordinary defendant, we would charge this person with obstruction of justice. But because it's the president, we don't make a decision and we leave that open. Again, I'm not saying that it does say that, because obviously that would be irresponsible, but I think it could, right? I mean, I certainly think that's within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it says the report leaves unresolved. I'm reading it right here. Unresolved what the special counsel views as, quote, difficult issues, close quote, of law and fact concerning whether the president's actions and intent could be viewed as obstruction. So that really makes it sound like Mueller does not reach a conclusion.
I think that's right. But I would point out it doesn't say it says difficult issues of law and fact. I think the law component is in there for a specific reason, and I think that refers to the overall uncertainty about what is required to make a decision to prosecute or indict a sitting president. I kind of want to get back to the question of why. So you know, we talked about reaching a conclusion in part one, and I think you gave a really good, sort of notion of finance. Yeah, it's been 2 years. It's been comprehensive. I have reached enough of an opinion to say that there is no direct conspiracy in these two issues, despite the fact that you know, there's still evidence yet to come in. And, you know, we didn't talk about the, you know, Trump Tower meeting. I mean, that obviously there's a lot of that still out there. On part two, my biggest question, the thing that I can't figure out, is why Mueller was satisfied with just getting written answers from Trump with respect to obstruction of justice. And, you know, and the model that I use for comparison is the Starr investigation of Bill Clinton. Ken Starr sent a subpoena to the White House and then ultimately negotiated to have Clinton testify in front of the grand jury via closed captioned or closed circuit TV. You know, for Thomas and our other listeners, that was sort of the Skype of the 1990s. his lawyers would be allowed to be present, and that was really the moment, right? The certainly of the two articles of impeachment. Article one that was voted out by the full House related to Clinton's testimony during that August 17th, 1998 television appearance before the grand jury. So why do you think Mueller didn't do that with Trump? Didn't even try to issue a subpoena to the president?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. I actually think, well, the big difference between Trump and Clinton is that Clinton actually cared about norms and about, you know, appearances, public appearances, about, you know, what it would look like if a president refused to cooperate with an investigation, and was sort of guided by all those traditional norms that Trump has just completely blown up, right? And I think, actually, if I'm Mueller, tactically, he probably made the smart decision in going with the written answers, because it was a negotiation. Both sides had some leverage, right? Mueller can threaten to subpoena the president, and the president's lawyers can threaten to, you know, not cooperate and have a two-year court battle. So the compromise was take the written answers. And I think Mueller was probably smart to take that as the best he could hope for and move on, because the alternative is, I think, you subpoena the president, you have a big court fight over, you know, executive privilege and what have you. Maybe you win after months more delay, although that's not a sure thing. And then if you win, the president comes in the grand jury and takes the fifth, or, you know, asserts executive privilege. And then you go back and have another court fight about that. And I think that ultimately probably would have proved to be a 1 or 2 year legal battle that would not have helped Mueller get to the truth, you know, and his goal was to get to the truth, not to ultimately, after 2 years, get the president in the grand jury and see if maybe he'd lie about something, which, you know, he likely would have. So I think, you know, I think if you want to get to the truth expeditiously, that the way Mueller ended up approaching this was probably the best he could hope for, given you had a president who wouldn't care about, you know, stonewalling investigation. And he'd go out to his base, he'd go out to the public and say, you know, I'd love to go tell Mueller everything that happened, but my lawyers tell me I've got to take the fifth because it's a witch hunt and they're not going to treat me fairly and I can't cooperate with, you know, the Mueller and his 13 angry Democrats. And so I've got to follow the advice of my lawyers and take the fifth. You know, I think that might well have happened. And then you still don't have his testimony.
I think that that's really, really perceptive. Let me ask as a follow up, do you think that reaching that judgment, right, saying, I don't want to be embroiled in an additional 2 years of a court fight that, you know, at the end of the day is going to go to a Supreme Court that, you know, now has Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh on it. Do you infer anything out of that that would perhaps imply that Mueller's view of the president's involvement is less serious than in the Clinton and Nixon cases, right? Because in both of those cases, you had, you know, a prosecutor that decided to wage those fights. And you know, I I don't know how much the norms question applies to opening arguments, good friend Richard Nixon. It clearly more so than Trump, which is, you know, yet another one of these things that if you'd told me 3 years ago, I would be saying, but Richard Nixon in public a lot, I wouldn't have believed you. So do you read anything into that, or you know what? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I don't know. But I guess I feel like that's getting pretty speculative. I mean,
yeah,
I just read into it making kind of the best tactical decision, taking the best you think you can get, that being the written answers, in a reasonable time frame, and recognizing that even after a lengthy battle, you might not end up getting any more than that anyway. So sort of a tactical call that I actually think probably made sense.
Okay. Can I cut in here with some breaking news as we're recording? You know, the report that totally exonerates Trump, McConnell blocked a resolution to have it be revealed to the public by Democrats. So how does that make you feel about that? I mean, it certainly seems like at the very least, if this report were everything Trump and Don Jr. were saying, total exoneration, totally all that stuff, it seems that even Mitch McConnell would make it visible to everybody. I don't know. I can't think of a reason other than there's something bad in the report that he would do this.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. But I mean, there's such momentum for the report to be public. I can't imagine that's not going to happen and fairly quickly. I mean, when you got the president himself saying that's what he wants.
Yeah.
Barr committing that that's what he wants to do. I mean, I don't hear a lot of voices on the other side. Maybe Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Aside, saying it shouldn't be public. So I can't imagine that's not going to happen. They'll have to scrub it a little bit for some of the grand jury material and things like that. But I'd be really surprised if we don't see, you know, the vast bulk of the report fairly soon.
Yeah. And as we pointed out previously, right, I don't know if anything in the Starr report was redacted. I mean, if and obviously that discusses in a summary way grand jury testimony. So, you know, we've been kind of taken as a given the requirements of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure that grand jury testimony be kept confidential. But it seems to me that the standard for that is very, very narrow, right? I mean, we're not talking about a lot of scrubbing that needs to be done, right?
You wouldn't think so. I mean, for example, I think Mueller did a lot of interviews outside the grand jury, you know, just interviews with the FBI that they then record in this form they call a 302, you know, a report of an interview. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those were turned over in connection with the Hillary Clinton email investigation. And those aren't grand jury material. It's only if the witness actually goes in the grand jury and testifies. So, you know, consensual interviews are fine. There's should be a lot of material. And you would think, you know, hopefully, that Mueller wrote his report with an eye to that. In other words, if you think ultimately that this is a product that you might want to release to the public, you could write it different ways, you know, to put less emphasis on actually revealing grand jury material and more on material that gives you the same information, basically, but that would not be protected by Rule 6E.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Just a couple more questions where I want to pick your brain. I want us to go back. We'd hinted at this earlier. This is, again, from the last full paragraph on page 3, where Barr is describing how he and Rod Rosenstein made the determination that on the basis of reviewing the Mueller report, that there was not sufficient evidence to charge the president with obstruction of justice. And he notes, in making this determination, we noted that the special counsel recognized that, and then this is an internal quote from the middle of a sentence, but that the evidence does not establish that the president was involved in an underlying crime related to Russian election interference, end of that internal quote, and that while not determinative, the absence of such evidence bears upon the president's intent with respect to obstruction. I read that as importing into the judgment here, the position that Barr laid out in his confidential memorandum to Rod Rosenstein from 2017, and his oft-stated position that to have obstruction, you must have a predicate act, underlying act, that is itself unlawful, something like intimidating a witness or destroying documents or perjuring yourself. And this is something you've written about a lot. I was curious if you read this the same way I do, that in other words, that this is still importing into the determination, you know, kind of an idiosyncratic view of what constitutes obstruction of justice. And I thought you might run with that a little bit.
Sure. I don't really disagree with that sentence, although I think it's kind of a matter of degree. But I think what he's saying is, and it's been misinterpreted in some of the reporting out there with commentators saying, you know, Barr said you can't obstruct justice unless the underlying conduct that you're trying to cover up was also a crime. And that's not true. But the letter doesn't really say that. It says it's relevant to intent. So it's not determinative, you know, whether there was an underlying crime, in this case, conspiracy. But that is relevant to intent because, and I think that's right, because when you're trying to prove obstruction, you're trying to prove, you know, by circumstantial evidence what was in someone's head when they did a certain thing. It's an important fact to say, was there something, you know, really bad that they did that they would have a reason to cover up? If you think about the Michael Flynn story, for example, when the president, you know, cleared the room and then told James Comey, I hope you can let this go, Flynn's a good guy, you know, that was one of the key potential allegations of obstruction. Mm-hmm. The reason that's powerful is the implication that he wanted to the Cohen case dropped because he was worried Cohen was going to rat him out about Russian conspiracy, right? So if it turns out there was no Russian conspiracy, there was no evidence of Russian conspiracy, then that becomes a less powerful inference when you're trying to prove the president's intent beyond a reasonable doubt. And it becomes more reasonable for the president to say, I just felt sorry for him. I thought he was a good guy. You know, I just wanted to tell Comey that. But I wasn't trying to cover up anything because there was nothing to cover up. You know, so again, it's not determinative, but is it relevant? Yeah, I think it's relevant. But you know, the other side of that, or the other important point, is you could be trying to cover up things. You could obstruct justice to cover up things that aren't criminal. Right. And this is what a lot of other commentators are kind of missing. I think there's a lot of commentary today about, well, why did everybody lie if there was no conspiracy? Why did everybody lie? Why all the lying? Why all the lying? There's actually a pretty simple answer for that. People lied about the Russian contacts, not because the underlying contacts were criminal necessarily or established a conspiracy, but because they would have been politically devastating. You know, you lie about them because if they're revealed, it's going to destroy the president politically, undermine the legitimacy of his entire election by suggesting maybe the Russians helped, you know, or maybe we had all these improper contacts. And so there are a lot of reasons to lie to investigators or to cover up things, you know, when the underlying actions aren't criminal. So it's not a requirement, again, that the underlying activity be a crime. But if it were, then that would make the inference stronger that that's why the president did what he did. So I, you know, it's a matter of degree, and I wouldn't phrase it as definitively or strongly as Barr does. But I get the point, and I don't think he's actually wrong.
Okay. I think that's really interesting. I would point out the next sentence then says, in cataloging the president's actions, many of which took place in the public view, which, you know, of course, implies that there are some that did not. The report identifies no actions that in our judgment, and then it lists three different things that those actions must do, right? They must, one, constitute obstructive conduct, two, have a nexus to a pending or contemplated proceeding, and three, were done with corrupt intent, each of which then is required to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I certainly read that as saying, if we have any reasonable doubt as to any one of those three elements with respect to any conduct, then we would reach a conclusion of, you know, declining to prosecute, that this does not constitute obstruction of justice. Is that how you read that paragraph as well?
Yes. I mean, so the standards of prosecution are, you're not supposed to bring an indictment. I mean, the standard to get the indictment is only probable cause, of course, which is far lower. But you're not supposed to return an indictment unless you think there's a good chance that you've got admissible evidence that will allow you to prove guilt to unanimous jury beyond reasonable doubt if you go to trial. So if in your mind as a prosecutor, you don't have that evidence, you can't prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt as to any one of those elements, likely, then that's a reason to decline to prosecute. Again, it doesn't mean that there's no evidence, and it doesn't mean that whatever the president, you know, did do was okay or not otherwise, you know, deplorable, but you're making a criminal judgment about whether to indict someone who's presumed to be innocent, and the only way you can convict them is to prove 12 citizens unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt that all of these elements of obstruction of justice are met. And that, you know, that's a high bar.
Yeah. And I would contrast that with the two articles of impeachment that were voted out of the House in connection with Bill Clinton, contained as a summary after the specific allegations, the statement: "In doing this, William Jefferson Clinton has undermined the integrity of his office, brought disrepute on the presidency, betrayed his trust as president, and acted in a manner subversive of the rule of law and justice to the manifest injury of the people of the United States." I certainly have always interpreted that from the beginning of the show and the beginning of Yodel Mountain as saying that the standards for impeachment are different than the standards that we just went through in terms of whether you would prosecute an individual as, you know, a private citizen for obstruction of justice. Do you agree with that, or am I off base, or what do you think?
No, absolutely. I mean, because that recitation that you quoted, I mean, those are not criminal offenses, right?
Right.
Impeachment is a political remedy. And so it's a different standard. And so, I mean, a fundamental reason we need to see Mueller's report and his own findings and not simply Barr's summary legal conclusions is that the question of impeachment is a different standard. It's a political process, not necessarily a criminal one. And different standards apply. So there may well be there's clearly evidence of conduct that looks like it might be obstructive in the report. Even Barr's letter says that. The Mueller lays out evidence on both sides. And that evidence, even if it didn't justify a criminal prosecution, could well lead the Congress to decide that it justifies impeachment. It's a different standard. So that's another reason that, you know, Congress and the people really need to see the actual report so Congress can make that judgment.
Oh, amen to that. I, on the one hand, I want to end with that because I think that's a perfect summary of where we are. On the other hand, I've got one more question I really, really want to pick your brain about. And this is the one I know the least about. I really can't figure out. And I'm sure you have a good answer to it. And that is, assuming that the Barr report is accurate in describing the contents of the Mueller report, which, you know, that's the assumption we're making here. And I think it would take a lot it would take seeing the Mueller report and having it, you know, be contradict what Barr has said. But I don't have any reason to believe that. I think Barr is spinning it. I think that's, you know, probably where we all line up. I'm just sort of left with this nagging doubt of this, the question we asked you, I think the last time we had you on, which is, okay, you know, Michael Flynn got an awful sweetheart deal out of this. And so did an awful lot of people. And some of them you can figure out, right? Like Rick Gates, it's pretty easy. Gates got a sweetheart deal because he brought down Manafort, and Manafort is a horrible scumbag who laundered hundreds of millions of dollars. Why did Flynn get such a sweetheart deal if there are no more indictments pending and this is it?
Yeah, I think that's really, I'm probably going to disappoint you and not give you the great answer you're looking for. I think it's really hard to tell from the outside of the investigation. Maybe the report will shed more light on that. But I mean, two things. First of all, I'm not sure we know. I mean, sweetheart deal implies that there was a whole lot of worse stuff that he could have been charged with that he wasn't. And I'm not sure we know that. I mean, beyond lying to the investigators, you know, his contacts with the Russian ambassador and things like that may have been sort of reckless and unwise, but not necessarily criminal. You know, so was it really a sweetheart deal, or was that really sort of the essence of his crime? Just lying to the FBI, which is what he pleaded guilty to. But you make those judgments. I mean, that was pretty early on in the investigation, you know, relatively speaking. And so those are the kinds of judgments you make sometimes. You know, you're trying to flip people and see what else they know. And you know, he met with the investigators. What was he the one that met with him 19 times or something like that? You know, so clearly they thought he had a lot of information, and he may have provided a lot of information that ended up helping them reach the conclusions that they reached. Even if that information did not result in additional indictments, he may well have helped them get to the bottom of what, you know, did or did not go on. And so you can be, you know, helpful in that regard as well, even if it ends up not resulting in another big criminal case.
Well, no, I think that's a good it's a good lesson kind of to end on in terms of trying to read the tea leaves. I should it, in my view now, I think Judge Ellis owes Robert Mueller a pretty significant apology as well. But maybe we don't need to go down that rabbit trail. Thomas, I don't know if you want to
well,
add anything.
Yeah, I can try to end this a third different time and just, I'm just curious, Randall, what, I mean, all these, detailed points aside or maybe included, how do you feel about this? What do you feel like we're going to see in this report? You know, what's kind of going through your mind as a result of all this, just big picture?
Well, I'm not terribly surprised about the conspiracy part. I've been saying for a long time, I thought there was a pretty good likelihood that Mueller was going to conclude that these interactions with the Russians were, you know, reckless, irresponsible, naive, whatever, but not necessarily criminal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of the Trump campaign did not come across as the kind of sophisticated, you know, organization that could enter into this high-level conspiracy and keep it quiet. They seemed more like they were flailing and groping around for information and trying to accept help from whatever quarter they could. And, you know, I think that's probably what Mueller has ultimately concluded, right? There was a lot of reckless, careless, bad stuff going on, but no sort of high-level, you know, devious criminal conspiracy with the Russians. And I think the country should feel happy about that. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of a relief to know that, you know, the current sitting president, whatever else he's done, you know, his campaign didn't conspire with Russia to get him elected. I mean, so to that extent, I feel not surprised. And I think, you know, I have a lot of confidence in Mueller's conclusions. The obstruction thing, I really want to see the actual report, because it's clear that there's a lot of information in there on both sides. And we can't just rely on you know, sort of Barr's summary. We really need to see what exactly Mueller found to make those judgments. So that's sort of where I come down on again, the whole thing just emphasizes how much we have to actually see the actual report. And I think that'll happen.
Do you think there could be a lot of, or I guess how much do you think there could be impeachable stuff, highly embarrassing stuff, but not illegal? That we might discover.
I mean, that's going to be a political judgment, you know? Yeah. And the House has, of course, to consider, you know, not only whether, you know, even if they pass articles of impeachment, how likely is the Senate to convict? And that's, you know, I'm not really a political analyst. I mean, I guess it strikes me that if there were going to be something that really caused a sort of landslide momentum for impeachment and even brought some Republican senator, it would have been the Russian conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And if that's not in the report and the obstruction evidence is kind of, you know, iffy, you know, 50-50, could have gone either way type thing, that strikes me as something that's not likely to maybe even the House to even start impeachment proceedings. Maybe they just take it and use it, you know, to try to win the 2020 elections, but don't, you know, get bogged down in impeachment that would ultimately not be successful anyway. But, you know, I guess I'm not a political analyst. That's not really my thing, but that's sort of my sense of it, I guess.
All right. Well, I guess we'll draw it to a close there. What do you think, Andrew?
Oh, I think that's great, and I really appreciate Randall. Thank you so much for Absolutely. Coming on and sharing your expertise with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and this I thought was a great breakdown and some insight into, you know, what may have been going on inside Mueller's head. But you know, we ultimately agree on the final conclusion, which is, you know, this tiny little 3.5-page letter just really underscores the importance.
Let's see that full report that exonerates Trump completely, huh?
Got to see the report. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right.
It's always a pleasure, guys.
Yep. Anything we need to point people to?
No, the usual. I mean, the Washington Post columns or the blog sidebars, or if you've got listeners in the D.C. area, I'll be doing that talk again on the April 17th for Profs and Pints. You can come out and hear about the history of the Mueller investigation. Go to propsandpints.com and come out and have a beer. And
why is everything cool over there and not where I am? That sounds really fun.
Just a road trip, Thomas.
A road trip from California. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that sounds really cool. I'm glad you tossed out that plug, because I do know there are plenty of listeners in that area, so they should check it out.
I thought I was going to see Andrew with the last one, but I look for you.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. But I will definitely be at the April 17th Profs and Pints, profsandpints.com. I will be there. I can't wait. You gotta make sure I'm on the guest list though. So
yeah, you got turned down by security, you know, Andrew.
Yeah. I went up to the velvet rope and I said, no, they were like, Mr. Eliason has not heard of this, Mr. Torres, burly gentleman escorted me out in a rather, unceremonious fashion.
Yeah. Sorry to hear that.
All right, a big thank you again to Professor Eliason. That was great stuff. And now it is time for us to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over at patreon.com/law. Never been a better time. So much good stuff. That bonus episode for you. Oh, man, it was so fun. For listeners who haven't caught it, you know, that was opening arguments live, uncensored, and talking about the Clinton impeachment and some other stuff. So that was a lot of fun. It was a necessary letting off of some steam, I think. But hop on over to patreon.com/law and check out that good stuff. And now let's thank our Hall of Famers who are the ones responsible for bringing you this fine show. Thanks to Mitch, son of a... it's cut off, but I think we know what follows. Jennifer Kratch, Herschel Ostropoler, I don't know, sorry. Radiantly Beautiful Goddess is an anagram of Barbara Lawal. I'm not a English major, but I'm not sure about that. Cut Maps, Malcolm Reynolds is my favorite captain. Jean-Luc Picard is a close second. Steven Baltikai Sandoval, we are going to build a Death Star and make Alderaan pay for it. You have due process rights as long as you can pay the balance too. Wow, yeah, that's a good one. Take my money, you filthy animals. Devin Nunes, Cal Lee's legal team. Oh, man, we still haven't gotten to talk about that. Dirk Patron, Bar's summary, worst cliff notes ever. John Bilderback, Trump is a one-chugga chump. That's awesome. My knuckle tattoo says open args. Oh, these are good stuff. open args across the knuckles. That's perfect. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters podcast. I hope the Democratic VP nominee is a woman so Pence can debate her. I hope the main nominee, the actual presidential nominee, is a woman. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Burbank Makerspace. Gideon v. Wainwright versus Stone Cold Steve Austin. Rumble in the Jungle. A string of unimpeachable character. DataHack.com, business automation, making the menial automatic. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. A banana socialist democracy. At women for Brian Z. Love with your heart. Use your head for everything else. Kurt Robinson, Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Schrodinger's Andrew is wrong and right and wrong at the same time. Cosmo, there are eight chuggas blues. I totally agree. Michael Cohen is a no talent ass clown. The Getting Off Podcast. Sam Buck, Milo Mead Song, The Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. Chris Rowden, Baseball is Back. Karma Fleet is Recruiting. Eve Online Players. Mike the Intactivist. Join Your Labor Union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. I stand atop Yodel Mountain and I sob, for I stand on a molehill. Ooh, I don't know about that. Polly Chuck, David from Brooklyn, James, a summary of a report is an anagram of unpronounceable characters. There was no corrosion, rust as a ruse. And cutting out the middleman to fund Eli's legal defense. Wow. All right, your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thank you too, Anonymous, to Buttercup's Legal Services is buzzing about Honey Tree Meadery in Nashville, 831 Cat Law 1. To Devin Nunes as the arch nemesis of the taint team is canon now, right? To another Anonymous, to your local garrison of the 501st Legion wants you, bad guys doing good. Formal ass nut is almost an anagram of Paul Manafort. PSA, take off your clown horn backpack on public transport. Yeah, all right. Melissa Forethought. I always read that as if it's a real name instead of Melissa Forethought. Yeah. Devin Nunes's cow is Twitter's real property. Yeah, we will cover Devin Nunes's crazy lawsuit. Just, you know, a couple things have gotten in the way. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Liberal Gun Club, a pro-Second Amendment voice for left-of-center gun owners. Derek, a pack of howler monkeys tired of being compared to Republicans. Sansom Street Sluggers will hoist a Yodel Mountain lager for Andrew. Well, thank you. And our number one patron, as always, Liz Weeks. That's the name, not the
That's one way to do it, huh?
Saul, overturned Citizens United to unseat Conrad Michael. Nice. Well, that's a preview of upcoming episodes. So.
Yeah.
Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. Zabby, chugga, 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 and it keeps going. See, that's why I'm a three chuggas kind of guy. I get the it's got to be an even, but like I just don't have the time for that many chuggas.
But that means you're in like a 3-4 time. Are you a natural waltzer? Well, chugga, 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 choo, choo, dun, two, three, four, five, six.
One. I think we all know that the answer to that one. So, episode should begin with Andrew's best. Good news, everyone. Yeah, no, we tried that. Brandon Smith, I guess George Pell lived an otherwise blameless life too, clown horn. Yep. Patreon goal, Thomas C's endgame on opening night. Oh, that is an excellent Philosophers in Space Patreon goal.
Is that so, the new
That's the Avengers, book? Avengers the, endgame,
oh,
yeah.
Gosh, all right.
Oh, man.
we'll see.
Rhonda Apple, Malaika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, a glam rocker of Spiro Agnew might exist, fund wormhole inventors. Sure. CampQuest.org, 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 Soggy Pants, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, spending a year dead is a great way to avoid tort law liability. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Get a transcript of OA by listening again and typing fast. that's so good. Aaron Grady, don't take legal advice from patrons, but do throw eggs at fascists. Yeah,
yes.
That's I agree with the first half of that. Ian and Allie, Sakashite Fukusumi, just a snowflake who became part of the avalanche. Oh, nice. I like that. St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers. He still is. Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, sometimes you get the bar memo and sometimes the bar memo gets you. Devin Nunes is ex-attorney Larry Klayman, and I think he sent us a message that we left him off 1 week, so I'm going to read him twice. Devin Nunes is ex-attorney Larry Klayman. Does OA LLC have a nepotism policy? The credits are all Smiths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the policy is finally, lots of nepotism.
And finally, our all-time patron, our number one, the Hall of Famer, he who shall not be dethroned, but keep trying, and the subject of one of our latest Twitter accounts, Conrad Michaels. Yeah. Conrad Michaels.
Conrad Michaels. Michaels is like the Patriots, except if they weren't really hateable. Like if everybody loved the Patriots, but also they won every time. It's like that.
Yeah, yep. it's like what Yankees fans think the Yankees were in the 1920s to the 1940s, right? Like when they just won every year, and
I'm sure
Yankees fans are like, that was wonderful, right? Yeah. So,
oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, it's time for TTTBE. Sometimes the bar, sometimes you get the bar, and other times the bar gets you. Let's see. I got that one wrong, but it was, you know, so I'm on a bad streak, but that's okay. Let's see if I can pick myself up and get a question right here.
All right, Thomas. A bus passenger was seated next to a woman whom he did not know. The woman stood to exit the bus, leaving a package on the seat. The passenger lightly tapped the woman on the back to get her attention and to inform her that, you know, hey, she'd forgotten her package. Because the woman had recently had back surgery, the tap was painful and caused her to twist and seriously injure her back. If the woman sues the passenger to recover for the back injury, will she be likely to prevail? Answers. A. No, because she is presumed to have consented to the ordinary contacts of daily life.
Huh.
B. No, because she was not put in apprehension by the touching.
Oof.
C. Yes, because the passenger intentionally touched her. Or D. Yes, because the passenger's intentional touching seriously injured her.
Wow, what a quick, simple question, but it's a good one. I like it. It sounds like I'm going to have a tough time with it because it's going to depend on knowing the proper language of why. Because, like, this absolutely has to be a no, right? I mean, I hope we don't live in a world where if you lightly tap someone on the back and they turn and hurt themselves, then you're paying for their injury. I would hope that that's not it. But so I'm going to go ahead and right off the bat, I'm going to Thomas's second chance, eliminate the yes answers. I don't even want to see those yes answers. Get them out of my face, Andrew. Cut them out of this question. I don't want them. No yes answers. So we got A, no, because she is presumed to have consented to the ordinary contacts of daily life. That sounds plausible. I've never heard that language before, but it sounds plausible. Or B, no, because she was not put in apprehension by the touching. Not put in apprehension. I mean, that's all. So it's like, which legal language will best make sense is how I'm analyzing this. Presumed to have consented to the ordinary contacts of daily life. I mean, that sounds right. Not put in apprehension. I don't know. That also sounds like it could be the legal thingy. I don't know. Maybe you'll tell me, yes, that's the legal thingy. Here's being put in apprehension. But it doesn't, I don't know. I'm leaning toward A, because A just sounds very plainly correct. You know, like that's just everyday life. You're not going to A or B. I wonder if it's going to be something stupid and it's like C because the passenger intentionally touched her or something like that. But we threw away those yes answers. We got rid of them. There's not even any yes answers. You know, my first instinct is A, no, because she's presumed to have consented to the ordinary contacts of daily life. Could be wrong, but that sounds the most obviously right. And I'm just going to hope it's one of those obvious ones. So final answer A.
All right. Well, if you'd like to play along with Thomas on TTTB, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your answer, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Keep yodeling. Remember, Yodel Mountain is forever, everybody. I don't want to hear otherwise. I don't want to hear your negativity about Yodel Mountain being done. It's forever. We'll always have it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you very soon for... Oh, we forgot to announce the Q&A. Okay, we got to make sure to do that. We are going to be doing the live Q&A on Sunday the 31st at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll make sure to share it out everywhere to get people's attention who don't make it to the end of episodes. I mean, they're weak and they should make it, but, you know, we'll still help them out. But that's when the Q&A is. And of course, you'll have that Lot Awful Movies for you very soon. So thank you. See you then. We love you. Good night.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.